Dear sir or ma'am, peace be with you. My name is Feliciana Reyes, a World War II veteran in the Philippines, and I was with the Medical Corps 75th Infantry in Dumaguete, Negros Oriental. I enlisted and served under the flag of the United States during World War II. That service was not recognized. I'm hoping for your kind understanding and patience. More power to you. There are many like me, but most Americans don't know about us. Our story has been buried in time, waiting for you to discover.
In early 1942, just after the United States entered World War II, the Imperial Japanese Army battled American and local forces in the Philippines. The Japanese emerged victorious after a three-month battle and captured over 75,000 prisoners of war, including Americans and Filipinos. Days after the victory, starting on April 9th, the Japanese forced these men and women to undertake a grueling 8-day, 65-mile march, denying them access to food and water and beating them along the way. The narration you just heard is from the 2023 documentary A Long March by filmmaker T.S. Botkin, in which survivors and experts detail the march, the brutal conditions afterwards, and their fight for recognition today. The Bataan Death March is one of the darkest moments of World War II. And for years, those American and Filipino prisoners and soldiers weren't officially recognized for their service. But thanks to recent campaigns, which included efforts by retired Major General Antonio Taguba, the American government finally acknowledged the bravery of all those involved and has granted congressional gold medals to living veterans and their families. In today's episode, our hosts sit down with General Taguba to discuss how he learned of his own family's involvement in the death march from his dying father, how his family's service influenced his own, and why the general takes time out of his own schedule every year to travel across the country to deliver the gold medals to survivors and family members. I'm Carrie Varoufakis, and this is Army Matters.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Army Matters. I'm Lieutenant General retired Leslie Smith, the 66th Inspector General of the Army. And today I have with me my co-host.
The 15th Sergeant Major of the United States Army. Not as prominent as 66, but maybe better. I don't know.
Well, that just means...
What?
We got fired more often than Sergeant Majors.
That's right. And so who do we got today, Les?
So, Dan, how much do you know about the Asian Pacific Theater during World War II?
Well, I mean, I know some.
Yeah.
My degrees are in history, and I studied European history, specifically in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So a lot about the European campaigns.
Yeah.
But didn't focus much on the Pacific campaigns. You know, when I was growing up, before I was in the Army, I thought, oh, that was a Navy Marine Corps fight. Mm. Yeah, yeah. So
little did we know, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it didn't interest me. But now that I've been older, I know a little bit more about it.
You know, this is interesting. I wonder if it's just because of understanding other folks' cultures, we gravitate to a culture that we may understand a little bit more than others. For me, when I was stationed in South Korea for 2 years, yeah. We had to take a class. And so you start to learn about the history, and it's amazing. I mean, just the breadth and depth. And even today, what's our biggest challenge? You know, land forces Pacific, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Our guest today knows a lot about this subject.
Yeah, he does.
His father, well, was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So have you worked with General Taguba over the years?
I have not had the pleasure.
Yeah.
When you mm-hmm. have legends like General Taguba, you know, those names tend to float around the service, but never had the pleasure of working with them.
For me, I was a battalion commander around the time that he was a Sister Division commander for 24th Infantry Division. Now, probably the toughest thing that, that we saw him do of having to do that investigation about Abu Ghraib.
Oh, wow.
That's something tough for general officers to have to do. But to do that investigation had to be one of the toughest things that he had to do, I think, in his Army career.
Yeah. Even the best institutions in the world make mistakes, but those that learn from them, grow and admit them, move on.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we're here, right? To help talk about the profession, and General Taguba played a key role and part in that.
Yeah. Well, why don't you bring him on the show?
Sure. So Dan recently sat down with General Taguba. Yes, he did. He did an episode without me. I feel a certain kind of way about it, but I'm going to let him slide this time because it's so important.
It was painful, Les.
Yeah, I know it was. It was painful. I'll come down and give you a hug later. So Dan, should we get to it?
Let's do it.
All right, let's get to it now.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Army Matters. I'm Sergeant of the Army, retired Dan Daly, and I have the honor and privilege of talking with our special guest today, Major General retired Antonio Taguba. General Taguba, welcome to the Army Matters show.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be participating in one of AUSA's podcasts.
You know, we have something in common. Your first name, General's first name, which I don't use General's first name. Their first name is General or Sir, but his first name is Antonio, which is my middle name. And it's a whole story of how I ended up with Antonio. But so we have something in common. But sir, let's just jump right in here.
Okay.
You're a soldier for life.
Right.
But why did you first want to join the Army, and when did that happen?
You know, I was born in the Philippines along with my siblings and my mom and my dad. And for the longest time, I didn't know why he was only coming once a year. And I was like 5, 6, 7 at that time. And we only saw him once a year. Mm-hmm. Little did I know that he had joined the U.S. Army at that time. Then we immigrated to Hawaii in June of 1961. And and then he retired in 1962. And then I go to high school in a place called Waiawa, which is right next to Schofield Barracks in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And junior Army ROTC was compulsory for the kids. All the boys have to enroll, or otherwise you don't graduate. And, you know, I thought it was going to be fun. It's a lot better than being on a Boy Scouts, right? Mm-hmm. And that generated my interest in joining the military, especially in the Army. I was fascinated with American history. I was fascinated with the military history, guns and things of that nature that we was introduced with in high school. And basically that brought it on.
So the focus of today is the Bataan Death March, which your father was involved in. Can you tell us what exactly he told you about the march?
Well, the conversations was not very much. We would ask him, hey, Dad, what'd you do in the Army? Mm-hmm. And he would be silent. He would just kind of look at us. He says, oh, not much. And he tried to stray away from that conversation.
Yeah.
But 4 months before he died in December 2011. He was suffering from dementia. He was 93 years old. And my sisters and myself are doing caregiving. So I just happened to be my turn, and he was just sitting there, very stoic. And I just happened to ask him, hey, Dad, what happened to you when you were at Bataan? Because I already had his record, you know, and he didn't want to read his record, by the way, because that's all history, right? So we're sitting there, and he looks at me and he says, well, I was captured. He knew the date, April 9th, 1942. There was a public affairs system that basically put the notice that we are surrendering tomorrow. For those of you who wants to escape, you can escape now. You have that opportunity. But he couldn't because he was sick. He had malaria. And I said, so you were captured. Were you beaten? I said, yeah, he was beaten. They stole his watch and his wedding ring. And then they assembled everybody on the spot. Whether you're ill or not, you're going to march one way or the other.
Many of the veterans from that generation were like that. They were very quiet about their service. They were very proud.
He also exhibited some behavior for someone that went to war. You know, we call that combat stress. Today is PTSD. Because during that generation, there was no such thing as mental health evaluation or post-health assessment or anything of that nature.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to talk about it. So I had to rely, we had to rely on his military record.
As recruitment increased in 1941, forces in the Philippine campaign grew to 120,000 Filipino troops, plus 30,000 from the U.S. mainland. In a country where rations were low, the new military was outfitted with used clothing and World War I weaponry. We were ill-prepared for the attack on December 8th, just 8 hours after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. Japan has undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts speak for themselves.
Over the course of 4 months, forces fell back from the Bataan Peninsula to defend Manila Bay on half rations with a diminished arsenal and no hope for reinforcements. Entrenched troops surrendered on April 9, 1942, the beginning of what would notoriously be known as the Bataan Death March.
Considering the situation of their troops, malnutrition, ammunition, and the overwhelming forces of the Japanese, they had made the decision to surrender.
So we're going to talk about the Bataan Death March here. Before we get into it, though, why is it important for Americans to know what transpired in the Philippines during World War II?
You have this story about Bataan, which is probably the worst defeat that the Army had experienced during the war, during World War II. And to this day, probably. It's when you have 72,000, according to records, historical records, that's a large amount of warriors that became prisoners of war.
Yeah.
700 Americans died, about 12,000 Filipinos had died. But it didn't end there. As I travel around, one of my favorite places would be go to an army museum. But there's a little piece of a display, like maybe a poster about Bataan. We don't talk about it as much as we want to in education or even in our military history classes. Even when I went to the National Archives, there's not enough about Bataan do that, or even the Center for Military History.
Yeah. So, sir, most of our listeners, and most Americans even to this day, know how when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, right? But as you mentioned, the Bataan is not as prevalent in the history books as the attack on Pearl Harbor. What are the conditions that led up to the Bataan Death March after the attack of Pearl Harbor?
Well, you know, you might say it started with War Plan Orange 3, which is the defense plan that MacArthur contrived. Was nicely planned, but it didn't have any resources. You have an invading force of about 100,000. He had about 31,000 army. And then all of a sudden you get other resources over that. And then they were not positioned to defend.
And the Japanese knew that this was a strategic location for the U.S. Army, right?
Right.
So what were the American troops doing there? Why did they pick the Philippines during World War II for the American troops?
The Philippines was priceless, not just in location, but also in economy. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of resources like wood, minerals, and things of that nature. And it is far away enough from Japan, who was then, we call China as our main adversary today, but Japan was our main adversary back in 1941.
Lesson or insight to share? Would you like to strengthen the soldier profession? The Harding Project, a grassroots effort, provides resources to help you develop and write articles and Army journals that can help influence the next generation of soldiers. For more information, go to hardingproject.com. Did you know, as a member of AUSA, you have access to many benefits? From car rental to entertainment discounts, the opportunities are ample. Visit AUSA.org/benefits to learn more.
Welcome back to Army Matters. We're talking with General Retired Taguba. Sir, can you tell us more about the Bataan Death March? I mean, what were the conditions like during the march and in the camps?
You know, I took my dad back in 1990, and because he hasn't been back since the war. So we go there through the Bataan Peninsula, and he just stayed in the car. He didn't want to get out. And he's looking around. And when I asked him, "What are you looking for, Dad?" He says, "Well, I want to try to find out the kilometer marker that he was captured at. Kilometer marker 165 is on his record." So I said, "Well, that is overgrown with cities and, you know, towns and whatever have you." But he was very stoic until my mother told him to get out of the car and kiss the ground, right? So yeah. That's kind of a tradition. Kiss the ground that you're at. So he kissed the ground. And for that matter, when I asked him, "What do you remember?" He said, and he, again, he wasn't talking about it. And I'm trying to envision thousands of thousands, according to history books, 72,000 were amassed along the whole peninsula, trying to either escape, trying to find a way to fight the Japanese, they can't escape through the Philippine Sea because there's no way to go. There's no boats or whatever have you. And MacArthur had already left to go to Australia. Chaos. There are no governors, nothing. And we've seen the film, 72,000 or 76,000 were being marched over 60 miles and being killed along the way.
Just tragic loss.
We have an oral history of Mr. Leda, who actually chronicled the march from Bataan all the way to Camp O'Donnell and later Kamanatuan. You could basically visualize that if you don't walk, you get bayoneted. If you can't escape, you get killed. And you're just left for dead along the way.
So then the ones that didn't die along the way, many of them died later on in the prison camps, correct?
They did. They separated the Americans from the Filipinos.
Mm-hmm.
And kept them as a bargaining chip for whatever purpose. I mean, would they do that to exchange for prisoners or whatever have you? But some of the Filipinos, most of them were let go. And they had to sign a loyalty sheet that if they are freed from the prison, they will not fight the Japanese. Some actually obeyed that loyalty pledge, and some became guerrillas.
So what happened to both the American and Filipino soldiers once they were released? Like you just mentioned, some of the Filipinos became guerrillas, but what about the American soldiers? What happened to them?
The American soldiers were basically put in separate, and there's about 3,000 of them, but they couldn't keep them there because operational reasons. So they put them on hell ships. I think there were three or four hell ships, and on cargo ships, they call it, and to be placed in prison camps to be forced laborers. In China, Manchuria, that location, and to be held until the war ended. And most of them actually were targeted by our airplanes, dive bombers and whatever have you, thinking that they're carrying cargo. Well, they were carrying prisoners of war, and they didn't have a sign or anything like that to tell to wave them off and whatever have you. Some of them were killed on that. Some of them were killed trying to escape or drowning themselves. And I think at the end of the war, there were less than 800 that survived the tragedy.
Yeah, I think that's the number I read too, right? Somewhere around 800. Yeah, that's from 72,000. That's just completely tragic.
Yeah, it's very, you talk about the process of elimination, right?
From Mariveles, 70,000 captured soldiers were marched 62 miles to San Fernando. There, they were loaded into boxcars for transport to Capaz, and then marched another 6 miles to Camp O'Donnell. During the week-long march, without food or water, and at the mercy of the mercenaries, some 700 Americans and 10,000 Filipino soldiers died.
In the process of walking in the death march, they would strike people for no reason at all. Citizens would try to hand food to the men that were in the death march, and sometimes they would kill them. In fact, there was one woman that they actually stabbed with a bayonet, and she was pregnant.
How did you get involved in raising awareness of what happened in the Philippines during World War II? Where'd that passion come from?
Well, it all started sometime around 2006, 2007. When I retired, my last duty assignment was at the Pentagon. I was approached by a group of World War II veterans, Bataan survivors. And the issue was that they were petitioning, pleading, protesting for their benefits, which I found out was caused by the Rescission Act, where we have the transcripts for that law. There were two Rescission Acts. One was, first one in 1946, February 1946, was because they could not pay the Filipinos for compensation owed to them, which according to VA at the time, between $1 to $3 billion. Well, that's the end of the war. There's no money and everything else was going to Europe. To alleviate that, they passed a law called the Rescission Act that basically said, well, they're Filipinos. They were not on active duty, even though they were called on active duty.
Yeah.
And we will revoke their U.S. nationality. This is written in law, which meant you can't pay them. So about 200,000 of them were not paid. And this group of elderly veterans, 80s, and some of them were in their 90s, was trolling around the halls of Congress. I was invited to go with them to find out what exactly is the issue. And the issue was recognition and being compensated. And that led us to organizing a group in October 2014 that we can't deal with Congress when they don't want to pay.
Sir, you then led an effort to get Filipino veterans the Congressional Gold Medal for their service. Can you talk about the process to do that?
We decided that we can't fight Congress and we can't fight the Army or VA in terms of more legislation and getting the veterans their money. So we decided that let's go for recognition.
Yeah.
We all decided collectively, well, let's build this legislation called the Congressional Gold Medal for them. At least not as a consolation, but something that they can memorialize. It took about 17 months to get it done. We started in 2014, and President Obama signed the bill in 2016.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Lobbying was not part of my competency, you know. But so we had to build it. Organize everybody across the country, letter writing and stuff like that, going around the halls of Congress. And we had an average of about 5 to maybe up to 20 minutes to educate members of Congress and their staff of where is the Philippines, what happened in the Philippines, and why are Filipino veterans involved?
Yeah.
Like Mr. Jesse Baltazar, who died before he can get his medal, fought in three wars. Retired as a major, to get a piece of metal, which is glorious in its design, and it's historic, you know, and it's in its appearance, just to get that would last a long time. You know, Mr. Ramon Regalado, 104 years old, was in a ICU in the hospital in Richmond, California. Got his money. He got his records. I get a phone call here in Virginia from his daughter, who I've never met, and says, my dad has been waiting for you for his Congressional Gold Medal. Right? Okay. So what does Taguba do? Get on the airplane, go all the way to Richmond, California, go find this hospital, and present Mr. Regalado his Congressional Gold Medal.
That's incredible.
With his family present in an ICU hospital. And he was basically almost catatonic, you know, unresponsive. But his daughter so he could hear. So we did the ceremony right there. And then I laid the medal on his stomach. And I feel this hand on my right wrist. He opens his eyes as he nods.
That's amazing.
And he dies the next week.
Oh, gosh.
So it's one of those stories that I don't forget that.
Yeah. And the impact you had on not just him, but his family, right?
Yeah.
His
yeah.
service mattered. And it might have taken a long time, but right. regardless, there's
regardless,
time yeah. is not a means to say that it's not important. It is not.
Right.
If it takes generations, as long as we get the recognition, it's important to people.
Yeah, they put the name on the map, you might say. And their family who will carry that legacy over time says, my dad served honorably.
Yeah.
And we're still doing congressional gold medal ceremonies. After
still veterans out there.
Yeah. I mean, it never ends because you get the word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is voluntary. It's out of pocket cost. So, but then we found several generals out there. Why does a general or admiral has to present it? I said, because they deserved a flag officer to present it to them because they never did. My dad would not promote to one star. He said, you know, to me that he's never seen or shaken the hand of a general officer before.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
It's a big deal, yeah. So I took my rank. I said, Dad, I'll shake your hand anytime.
Well, I know we're running short on time. I just want to tell you, thank you for all you're doing for our veterans out there. But more importantly, thanks for being a soldier for life.
Well, thank you, yeah.
Thanks for your 34 years of service to this great country.
Thank you for your service as well. And there's kids out there that when they serve, it matters. And we ought not to forget them.
On Army Matters, we often take our listeners on journeys around the world and share stories about adventure and inspiration. In today's spotlight, we focus on the people of our Potomac Liberty chapter and a recent event that transported guests to Italy and included wine. On March 17th, the chapter hosted the Lieutenant Colonel Ken Britt Memorial Scholarship Fund Wine Tasting Fundraiser in Alexandria, Virginia. The event, led by a top sommelier at Total Wine & More, was dubbed From Toe to Tip, a Wine Tour of Italy, and featured varietals from the entire country. Attendees learned about Italy, its people, and yes, its wine. The event was a huge success. Congrats to the event's organizer, Gordon Sumner, and the entire Potomac Liberty chapter. And if there are any bottles left over, feel free to send them over to us at AUSA. If you or your chapter would like to be profiled on the show, please email us at podcast@ausa.org. Saluti.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Army Matters is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission, educate, inform, and connect with the Total Army, our industry partners, and supporters of a strong national defense. Today's episode was hosted by Lieutenant General Retired Les Smith and SMA Retired Dan Daly, an anchor hosted by Carrie Viral Heckes. Anthony Del Call is the producer and writer, and Andy Bosnack is the supervising sound editor. Ellen Toner is the content editor. Lunzinga Curry is the executive producer, and the senior producers are Carrie Viral Heckes and LaSharon Duncan. Be sure to subscribe to Army Matters wherever you get your podcasts, and please leave a review. As you know, we love seeing stars in the Army, especially if it comes in the form of a 5-star review. AUSA's Army Matters podcast can also be heard on Reach Across America Radio on Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern, on the iHeartRadio app, the Odyssey app, and the TuneIn app with the search of the word REEF. AUSA's Army Matters podcast's primary purpose is to entertain. The podcast does not constitute advice or services. While guests are invited to listen, listeners, please note that you're not being provided professional advice from the podcast or the guest. The views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of AUSA. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@ausa.org. I'm with Sharon Duncan. Hope you have a great Army Day. Hooah!